Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And this week we have a really good interview with someone I admired watching compete. His name is Mike Francois, and he is from Columbus, Ohio. And Mike had a very powerful, thick physique, and he competed really only for a short time. He made it up to winning the Nationals in 1993, the MPC Nationals. And then he had a really good pro career. He started off winning his first four pro shows, including the Night of the Champions in 1994, which at the time was one of the biggest titles. And then in 1995, he won the Arnold Classic, beating out Flex Wheeler, who, of course, was one of the best pro bodybuilders around back then. So Mike had a really, really good career, but unfortunately, it was cut short because he had colitis, and he was not able to compete anymore, and they had to do a surgery, and he talks about that surgery in our interview today. And he also talks about his training program, because Mike was one of the most powerful trainers. He trained under Louis Simmons in Columbus, Ohio, so he was like basically a powerlifter bodybuilder, and he was extremely strong. And so Mike is going to talk about his training philosophy and how he was able to develop such massive size. And Mike was working with Chris Aceto, and if you listen to Chris Aceto weekly on Dave Palumbo's show, Heavy Muscle Radio, you'll know the name Mike Francois, because Chris talks about him a lot. So we got a really, really good interview coming up with Mike Francois in a second. And I do want to mention we are brought to you by Old School Labs. Now, I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe title in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion, and he's also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banoot and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you'll receive 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Just mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, or you can go to amazon.com and make your order there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right. And in other news, we had that terrible hurricane go through Florida last week, Hurricane Michael. And our guest next week, Richard Baldwin, who was one of the best amateur bodybuilders in the 1970s. And Richard competed in the 1979 and 1980 IFBB Mr. Universe contest. We had a really great discussion with Richard about the old days in bodybuilding. Unfortunately, Richard was a victim of that hurricane. He had a house in Georgia, and when I talked to him earlier this week, he was living at a hotel, and he did not know, but he feared at the time that they lost everything. They lost their house and everything in the hurricane. So we're trying to get a hold of Richard to find out what happened, and hopefully, I mean, he's okay, but hopefully his property is okay. I haven't heard anything, so that was really a terrible, terrible hurricane that we went through. Speaking of Richard, I saw the movie Bigger, which was the Joe Weider biopic that we've all been waiting to come out. And it did come out this last week on October 12th. And I finally got a chance to see it yesterday. And it was really, really cool getting to see so many people in a movie that I know in the bodybuilding world. Of course, you had Callum Van Moger, who I thought was the highlight of the movie, where he played Arnold Schwarzenegger. And they had the gap in his tooth. And Callum looked just like Arnold, and like a young Arnold, because he plays Arnold in 1970 when Arnold was 23 years old. And he also had a great physique, and he had the accent down perfect. So that was really, really a great part of the movie, was seeing Callum Van Moger play Arnold Schwarzenegger. They also had Sergio Oliva Jr. in there playing his father, of course, when they had the pose down at the 1970 Mr. Olympia contest. And then my friend Tim Wilkins was in it. Tim is one of the top MCs in the bodybuilding shows. He's also a stand-up comedian. And Tim was in there with Bob Ciccarillo, and they were doing commentary on the 1970 Mr. Olympia. So that was really cool to see Tim. Steve Cook, who I used to work with in Optimum Nutrition, he was in there for a little bit. So it was really, really cool seeing a lot of the people. And the movie, of course, is about Joe Weider and his life story. And Dan Solomon, my friend Dan Solomon, who lives in Florida, was very instrumental in getting that movie made, because he essentially brought it to a producer, Steve Lee Jones, who was one of Dan's college friends. And Steve is now in the movie business, and he is a producer. So Dan brought it to him, and this was right after Joe Weider died, and they thought it would be a great idea to do that. So they created this movie. It took a few years, of course, but they created this movie about Joe Weider. So if it's in your area, be sure to check it out. It's kind of a smaller movie, of course, so it's not going to be around for very long. It was at a theater out here in Tampa, Florida, the Veterans Theater, which I actually go to a lot. And so I got a chance to see it. So you want to check that out. If you don't check it out in movies, or if it's not near you, I'm sure it'll be coming to your cable system, and you can pay for movies that they usually have. Also, talking about Dan, I want to mention some really good news for him. American Media, which owns Muscle and Fitness magazine, they announced this week on October 10th that Dan has been hired as a vice president and the chief Olympia officer. So Dan is now going to oversee the company's Olympia brand, which includes, of course, the Mr. Olympia contest. So Dan is going to report directly to AMI Executive Vice President and Group Publishing Director Chris Scardino. So congratulations to Dan Solomon. That was a great, great news this week, and I just read that on Facebook. So congratulations to him. Oh, and I wanted to mention Richard Baldwin, like I said, because Richard will be our guest on the show next week. They actually feature a picture of his in the movie, so I don't think Richard knew about that, so I got to tell him about that. Go check out Bigger if it's in your area. If not, like I said, it'll probably be coming to your cable system where you can order it online. All right, I did get a couple emails in the last week, and if you have any questions or any concerns or any suggestions about the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I will read them on the air. I'm always looking for suggestions about the show, or also your thoughts and your comments about the show. This one says, Big John, my name is Bo Diaz. I'm a bodybuilder from 67 that competed in the Delaware Valley. And I was also a boxer, had a Joe Frazier's gym. I became a police officer, and I wanted to just say, keep up the good work on your show. I feel like a little kid listening to all them bodybuilders I grew up with. I was very good friends with Harold Poole to his death. I visited him in Florida. Annabelle Lopez, Bob Colucci, Warren Frederick. I knew Lou Ferrigno, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like I said, I love bodybuilding. And hopefully if you're in the area, New York, New Jersey, or Philadelphia, let me know. I can contact you with my phone number, and you got my email. God bless you, my brother. All right. Thank you, Bo. Also got an email from Paul Thorpe, and Paul said, Hi, John, greatly enjoyed the podcast. I've been listening for a long time now. So a message of thanks, long overdue. Two very contrasting guests in the last 2 weeks, as Tom Terwilliger was so full of life, positive, and had so much to say, where Roger Walker's interview felt like you were trying to get blood out of a stone at times. Still, testament to yourself on how you interviewed to keep it going and posing great questions to open them up for some insights into the golden era. Keep up the great work, Paul T. Okay, so that was all the emails that we had concerning last week's show. So like I said, if you guys want to email me next week about the Mike Francois interview or any suggestions you have about any new ones, I would be glad to read your emails on the air. Next weekend, I will be heading out, like I said, to Baltimore for my last conference with the AAAI-ISMA Fitness. And I'll be out there for the weekend. So if you guys are in that area, check them out at AAAI-ISMAFitness.com. If you want to come out and check it out, I will be out in Baltimore on Saturday and Sunday of this weekend, which will be the 20th and 21st. And I'll be giving my last seminar of the year for that conference. So I'm looking forward to that. The diet's really going good. I did make an arrangement to head out to Chicago in the middle of November, and I'm going to be shooting with Tony Mitchell. And I shot with Tony back in 2011. He was really a great photographer. So I'm hoping to shoot with my friend Rick Schaff again out here in Florida, and we'll definitely be in shape by November because I am super strict with the diet now, and it's coming down. I'm making really good gains every week, losing about a quarter of an inch a week off my waist. So really doing good on that. So not even craving any food because I'm so into the diet now. So my weight's down to about 200 pounds, and I got probably another half inch, maybe another inch to lose off the waist, and I'll be super ripped. So I'm looking forward to seeing those pictures because I'm really getting in great shape. Before we get to our interview with Mike Francois, I also mentioned that we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. And mention that you heard them on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. They will give you a free consultation, and they'll also give you 20% off anything you order your first time out. All right, so that is our opening, and here is our interview with the great Mike Francois that we did last week. Here you go. All right, welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I have a very special guest this week. His name is Mike Francois, and Mike was one of the top pros in the 1990s. He won the Arnold Classic in 1995 and also competed in several Mr. Olympias. So it's my pleasure to have you on the line. How you doing, Mike?
Good. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good.
Well, Mike, I got a chance to see you compete in action a few times in the 1990s when you did the Chicago Pro Show. And also, I was there when you won that Arnold Classic. So I thought you were really one of the most impressive physiques competing at that time on the pro level.
Yeah, it was a short-lived career, but it was fun while I did it and gave it everything I had. But it was fun. A lot of lasting friendships and learned a lot. That's carried on to my life now, too.
Well, Mike, I know you did a lot of heavy training. I talked to Chris Aceto. He was your coach back then, and he always talks, even to this day, about some of the amazing lifts you did and how hard you trained. So how did you get into weightlifting and bodybuilding? What was the start of your story?
Well, the start of the impetus for it all was athletics. I grew up in Iowa, and so I competed in everything from wrestling, basketball, football, track and field, baseball. So I just did it for those purposes, to get stronger for those things. As I later, I guess, probably the beginning of my high school days, when I was about 14 or 15, a freshman year, I started lifting seriously in the off season just to gain muscle and become a better athlete. And then it just kind of transitioned. I got hurt playing football my senior year, so I couldn't play college football. So kind of one of those stories a lot of people have. They just kind of gravitated toward the weights and had more time to do it. And so one thing led to another. Eventually, after college and graduate school, I started competing. And just one thing led to another. I had no intention. Didn't even know what a protein powder was until I got to college.
So
I was really, just ate food and lifted weights when I was a kid. And then, as we get older and learn more about it from all the people in the gym, I'm sure you have the same stories. Everybody had. There's usually a few people in the gym that you learn things from, and then it just kind of went on from there.
What was your physique like, Mike, when you started training when you were a kid?
I guess looking back, I'm not one to really be able to see what's in the mirror, but just judging from other people's comments, I was always pretty genetically, muscular, and the weights worked well for me as far as putting on strength and size. But even though I wasn't really aware of those things then, I was in it more for the athletic reasons. But looking back, I just had the propensity to be able to put on muscle more easily than some others, I guess.
Yeah, looking at your physique, you always looked like a mesomorph to me. You always looked like a kind of guy who responded well to the weight training.
Yeah, it worked out. Well, I picked the right parents.
So when would you become aware of bodybuilding? I mean, when you were lifting in high school and stuff, did you read the magazines at all?
No, I didn't. I just did not. I wasn't even exposed to it. I mean, I literally grew up in a town of probably 5,000 people, and it wasn't You know, I may have seen it on TV or I may have seen a magazine here or there, but I never looked at them.
Yeah.
I can't really remember anything about checking the magazines out, maybe till college.
Okay.
And then maybe even not really that much then. I didn't have any money to buy them, but
right.
Then later on, you know, I started looking at them obviously more when I started competing in bodybuilding. Then you want to see who you're going to be competing against, or you want to see the best guys, at least in the sport at the time.
Yes.
And then I started looking at them more, but you know, I never really was honestly a big magazine guy, just because I don't know why. I just never really was one to get into. I know all those people,
mm-hmm.
respect them all, and all that kind of stuff, but I just never really. Because I know certain guys can tell you which issue of this had to cover, you know,
right.
whatever, what it was. Just never really did it that much. And then I got involved in it, I really didn't look at it that much because those are the same guys I was competing against. I'd rather not even look at them. So
right.
I was raised, but that's what I was. Not that I never looked at them, but I just didn't live to see the next issue of the magazine.
Yeah. What college did you go to, Mike?
I went to a small college. It was a Catholic school in Iowa, Loras, L-O-R-A-S, Loras College,
uh-huh.
Dubuque, Iowa. I thought I was going to play college football, got hurt, couldn't do that, started thinking, reevaluating things, and I thought about the Catholic priesthood.
Right.
Yeah, I thought about it as early as second grade, but when you're in second grade, you see the priest, the church, you really don't know what they're doing and or what the rest of their life entails. So I didn't really know a lot, but it was just in the back of my mind, and when I got hurt, I saw God was leading me down that path. So I went to a Catholic college, and within that college, they had a seminary program. And then after that, my bishop sent me to study theology, which is 4 more years.
Mm-hmm.
He sent me to Columbus, where I am now, ironically. And that's where, you know, during my, say, another 4 years, of my 7th year, met a girl, fell in love, and can't be a Catholic priest and be married. So I had to make that decision.
Right.
And chose the relationship, and, you know, I guess the rest is history.
Yeah, that was your wife then, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, wow. So when did you start with Louis Simmons and the heavy training and all that? Because I remember hearing all those stories about, well, that's where I first heard about Louis Simmons' gym, was when I was reading stories about you, and he had this famous gym in Columbus, Ohio, and you were training there, and it's a small gym, right? It's just mostly for powerlifters and stuff.
Yeah, you know, I haven't been over there in years, but I know when I was there, I'm definitely kind of judging, but it couldn't have been more than 30 feet by 50 feet big. I mean, just for a small place.
Wow.
I mean, just no dumbbells. If there were, they're just kind of, you know, just old crappy ones and no machines. Maybe a T-bar row would be the only thing. Other than that, it's rack. It's a rack or two and then benches. But the thing is, some of the strongest people in the world, and still to today, you know, came out of that gym. And Louis knew how to put size on people and strength. And I knew with those things would come what I wanted to improve on my physique, the thickness and size. And so I was introduced to Louis probably had to be around 90, probably 92, 93-ish in there before I turned pro. So really improved. I went over there for a lot of things, but I went over there mainly for back and then shoulder training. Legs were never really a weakness, so I didn't do a lot of that there. And then, but a little bit of chest and mainly shoulders and back, and it made a huge difference. And, you know, Louis is one of those deals where Louis, up until then, and I'm not sure if it's changed much, but he just didn't even really care to have bodybuilders around. It wasn't his thing to have guys posing in the mirror, and he didn't have any mirrors, first of all, but he just wasn't into guys parading around with shirts off or whatever, and at this end of themselves, he was into guys that want to get stronger and bigger and would do whatever it took to get there. But I think once I got there and did my thing, he realized that's kind of my mentality. So, you know, he really worked with me, and he was a great guy. I mean, he motivated you, and he also knew, he's always coming up with new ways and new exercises and different ways of making you bigger and thicker, so it was a godsend for me.
Yeah,
and that's why I now work with training people. I try to incorporate a lot of his principles, and then along with some of the bodybuilding things, you know, obviously. So, but it was a great time. It was very, at the time looking back, you know, it was hard work and all that kind of thing, but I loved it. And also looking back, it was I'm grateful for his help.
Wow. Okay. So when did you start thinking about competing? When was that? Was that in like the early 90s, maybe 1990, 91?
Yeah, it was. Actually, I competed in one. My parents, I moved from Iowa to Missouri my sophomore year in college. and there was a Mr. Missouri contest one year. And so I went and watched, and I thought, you know what, I can maybe do this between, it would have been between my college and then starting graduate school. I thought, you know, I'm going to get ready and do this the next year, just kind of a last hurrah thing, because I'm going to go to the priesthood and I don't have time for this. Mm-hmm. So I did it. It was the Mr. Springfield, Missouri, and then the Mr. Missouri held in conjunction. So that was the first one, and that would have been 1987 going into 88.
Okay.
And, it would have been like 87. And ironically, looking back, she would kind of, you know, she didn't win. She got second, I think, in the women's division, Tanya Knight.
Really? And, wow.
Believe it or not, I know. At the time, I didn't know who this girl was, and then looking back and thinking, that was Tanya Knight up there. Amazing,
yeah, she was from that area, right?
Yeah, she's from, I think, the Kansas City area, but I think she got second, if I'm not mistaken. First, I think she got second, but then obviously she went on to be Tanya Knight, so it didn't matter. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's when I got started, and then, and ironically, on my thing too is that a priest friend of mine down there was going to go watch it, and because his brother was going to be in the show, but something came up, he couldn't make it, and he asked me if I wanted the tickets. So my brother Danny and I think it was Danny or Scott, one of my two younger brothers, went to watch it, and then that's when I said, you know what, I think I'm going to try this next year. So if it wasn't for the priest giving me tickets, you know, so I can blame him. It goes all the way back to him for not getting a priest.
Right.
It was a good time. So that was my introduction. You know, then I didn't even think about it. I just trained with weights still in graduate school, and I didn't really have any aspirations to compete. But then when things ended up like they did, I had more time to train, you know,
after
theology. And so that's when I got into it more heavily. And that was 1990.
How'd you do in that first show, Mike?
Very first show, I won the Mr. Springfield, and I got fourth in the Missouri Open.
Okay.
Or Missouri, I've been heavyweights at that time. No, it was light heavy. I was light heavy, actually.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you weighed.
You know, I couldn't tell you what I weighed, but it had to be under 198, right? So
yeah,
176 to 198. But I had no clue what I was doing. And, so it was, you know, I just had no idea. It was just eating. I think I don't even remember what I ate, but I know it was nothing like I ended up, you know, eating later. But
right,
you know, it was fun. It was a good experience. I didn't get last, I was able to win the Mr. Springfield, so that was, it was all gravy, you know, because I didn't think I was going to do it again.
How did your physique look back then?
You know, I think the structure was there. The strengths were your strengths then, because you didn't really know the difference between a strength and a weakness at that point. But it was okay. And I wasn't fat, but I wasn't shredded by any means. But I think the structure was there. I tell you this, one of my younger brothers, Scott, who's now an orthodontist in Kansas City, he did it maybe, man, I was married now, so it had to be sometime after, 1990, probably 92 or so, no, maybe 93 or 4, actually, he did it, and he was able to win the Mr. Missouri and Mr.
Oh, really?
Springfield. Uh-huh. Yeah. Talk about a genetic guy who just had the genetics. He never did anything after that because he went into dental school and stuff. But it's kind of a Francois tradition, I guess, to do the
that's right. So the first one I remember that you did, or the first time I heard your name, was when you did that Muscle Mania in Chicago in 1991. Because I think that was on TV. They had it on ESPN, or they had the results at least on ESPN.
Yeah. It was. I don't know if you remember Lou Zwick.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. So he got me involved in that, and so I won the Chicago. He had them all over the country, and I won the Chicago one.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great show, actually, and there's a lot of great lighting. I mean, it was the first time, and I think he tried to take it to another level with the venues, you know, kind of was a little ahead of his time in that regard. And so it was a lot of fun, and it was it really was, looking back again. You know, at the time, you don't think about these things, at least I didn't. I just kind of take them as they come. But it was a great springboard because you end up having a national call-in. I mean, at that time, too, like you said, it was on ESPN, which is unheard of now.
Exactly.
But it was great, and they showed highlights of the shows on there in that Muscle Magazine show. But then they had a call-in vote for the overall winner. Obviously, we didn't compete against each other, so it wasn't really – who had the best physique. It was whoever the audience wanted to pick. And so,
mm-hmm.
so, uh, so So that's how I ended up, you know, having more notoriety, I guess, through that show and things like that. But at the time, again, didn't even think about it, just kind of went along and did it. But looking back, I guess it was a godsend in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's right. Now that you mentioned it, I remember they had that call in and they picked like who was the most popular winner of all the WrestleManias.
Right.
Yeah.
So. But Dennis. I think Dennis Newman was one of them.
I can't
remember the other guys, but and Dennis obviously was a great bodybuilder.
He sure was.
Phenomenal physique. They got cut short too.
Yeah.
And a good guy as well. Yeah. So some good guys did it, and it was a good thing I think for bodybuilding at the time as well. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to get that same TV coverage as we used to get.
No, not at all. Not more. Right.
Kind of going backwards in that regard, but we have the internet and all that stuff too.
Right. And you did the Southern States in Florida too that year too, right, Mike?
Yeah, that was, he'd talk to me. Why'd you have to bring that up? So I went down there and don't have a lot of good memories in that one. I got third place.
Right.
I can't remember the guy's name, but there's two guys that beat me. And it's one of those things, I'll just be completely honest. It's one of those things where, you know, people are telling you've had this. You go off stage, oh, you got it. And I don't even know these people, so I don't know why you listen to them really, but it's what their feelings were. And I'm not the type to ever take anything for granted. I'm so probably too nose to the grindstone. Just, I don't even want to hear that because I never, ever want to be overconfident about anything. It's probably to a fault I'm like that, but so your mind kind of drifts towards that direction and you feel like you look good and all that, but I ended up getting third in my weight class. And then I think even in fact, the guy that won my weight class didn't even win the overall. I think it was,
Jorge Betancourt. Yeah. The middleweight.
So he ended up winning. Yeah. I mean, so somehow he ended up winning. And so it was pretty good. I think the guys who beat me, one guy won, his name Bruce somebody, and then Ken.
Bruce West and Ken Castagnoli. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. One ended up winning, I think, the Junior USA the next year or that year, and then won the Junior National. So they're good guys. So nothing, I mean, they were very good bodybuilders. I'm not sure, I think maybe Ken, I think he might have been in the Nationals the year I won the Nationals. And I remember showed just another kind of story like that. I ended up doing the Junior Nationals my first year. I competed in the second time around, kind of 1990. So I won a few shows around here, and then I went down to the Junior Nationals and got destroyed. I just got
destroyed. Really?
Wow. Oh, I didn't make top 15. I walked out. I was walked the heck off, got my stuff on, head back to Ohio. But
wow.
It was in New Orleans, of all things, so far down there. But just somebody kind of talked me into doing it after I won those other shows and said, hey, I'll take care of everything for you. I'll fly you down, da da da. So you're like, nah, you really don't want to do this because I'm the type of guy, if I don't know a year ahead of time what I'm going to do, I just don't like doing it. I like planning it out. Everything I do is going to be towards that, you know, goal, competing in that show. But I went ahead and did it. And you know, in the end, it's probably good that I did do it because it really showed me what I needed to look like to compete against those kind of guys at that level.
Yeah.
And in fact, Flex Wheeler was in it at the time. Paul DeMeo was in it. Jimmy Mintis was in it. None of those guys won our class. It was a guy named Richard Rothrock from.
I remember him. Yeah, he had a great physique.
Oh yeah, I mean, some guy you never heard from again, but had a great physique.
Right.
That tells you how competitive it was. You know, it was some good guys that year, and I swear, I don't know exactly, but in those days, you remember. It was probably 30 or 40 guys in that weight class. I
mean, for sure.
In those days, you would have more competitors, especially at that show, which had a very, you know, has a good following. And anyway, so it's kind of interesting, you know, looking back, you can see the different guys. But at the time, again, like I always say, you know, you didn't know who these guys really were, what they're going to go on to do. But when you look back, you're like, wow, there's some great guys there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did the Junior Nationals myself a couple times in the 80s, and it was super, super packed, very competitive.
Yeah, it's usually a very tough show.
Yeah, well, that's kind of inspiring to hear that you didn't even make the top 15, you know, way back then, and then you came back and eventually became a powerhouse on the national level and then turned pro, and you were a winner at the pro level, so that's kind of inspiring to hear that you started from those humble beginnings, you know?
Yeah, I tell people, I mean, you know, you probably do the same. I mean, you know who you are, right? You know, you're just a guy, and, yeah. and you just work hard. And I tell people that, man, don't let anybody tell you you can't do something. And it doesn't mean you have to go around telling people you're going to do it or, you know, be a brag or whatever. But just, you know, just in your heart, you got to know that you can do it and believe in yourself. And I try to instill that in people. I always say to myself, you know, somebody's got to win. Why can't it be me? You know,
right.
why can't it be me? Be that guy. Be the person yeah. that everybody wants to, you know, emulate or try to be like or whatever. Don't ever let anybody tell you you can't. And again, it doesn't mean you say that, but you got to let your actions speak, you know, in the gym and how you diet and everything like that. So that was always my philosophy when I was playing high school sports or whatever I did. I'm always thinking, you know, I don't need to be from a big city. I don't need to be any of these things in order to be the best. I just got to work hard. And, you know, there are some other elements. I get that, genetics, coaching, but you know, as far as what you can do for yourself, why not? Why can't it be you?
Yeah, you've always seemed like that to me, Mike. You always seem like a, you know, quiet confidence, and you just put your head down and worked hard, and you never were a big talker or anything, but your actions showed up on stage, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, you know, you're probably raised the same way. I mean, that's where I was raised. I mean, you grow up in a small town, and you do farm work in the summer, and you just work hard, and you see the people that are most successful in life, and everywhere in life, but in those small towns growing up, who are the most successful people? The people that work the hardest, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I always try to do. And my dad and mom, you know, we had 9 kids. And so they instilled that in us. That, you know, if you want something, you have to work for it. And but at the same time, my mom always said, I remember like it was yesterday, you know, I don't care how big you are, how strong you are, how wealthy you are, how good looking you are, whatever it is, there's always going to be somebody bigger, stronger, faster. So you got to continue to work hard.
Right.
That's what I tried to do. With everything I did.
So then in 92, you did the USA and you did really well there. So you must have made some really good progress from 91 to 92, huh?
Yes. I think, you know, I just got some people around me that were very knowledgeable. And then, you know, just as things grow, you mature, you kind of learn what you need to do to make your body grow. And you hone in on the diet a little bit more, the nutritional aspects of it and the training and whatnot. So, because in 1990, I mean, 89, 90, I was still training somewhat, you know, a little bit at the seminary, at the gym we had there. So I really wasn't full-time at a real gym even. And, you know, a lot of the time I was, but sometime I wasn't. So I think a lot of times it was just being exposed to different equipment, different exercises, different way of doing things, you know, people that were knowledgeable that helped me. And it seemed like every step of the way, just through the grace of God, I had the right person there, you know, whether it was Chris Cito, Ed Connors, you know, there's a guy named Marty Demersion that used to help people a lot. Marty was a good friend. I mean, just people along the way, whether it be financially when you're starting out or with the training or nutrition, you know, all those things. I had some great people from Columbus that helped me. So, and, you know, not to mention, you know, obviously my wife supporting me and my family. So it takes all those pieces of the puzzle to come together. And luckily at the right times in my career, I had those people around me. And, you know, so really nothing, it was really nothing that I did. It was more just, you know, people being put in my life at the right time and help me out.
Well, your physique had to be looking good at that time, though, right, Mike? Because if these people were, you know, getting behind you and helping you, they must have saw something in you that you could be a national champion.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that was there. You know, again, I'm the last guy that can assess my – when I look in the mirror, I would see the same guy, and I'm not really joking. I mean, this is pretty serious. I would see the same guy that won the Ohio, that won the Arnold Classic. I mean, I just can't – I see a little difference. I just cannot – but I can see it in other people all day long. I mean, I can see the littlest things in other people. But when I came to myself, I just had a crazy, almost too critical of everything. Because when I look, I don't know how you are, but when I look at my physique, I look right at the weaknesses. I'm like, oh, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And how I did what I did, I just don't see it. And so, but other people around me, thank God, had better vision of that all than I did. And so that helped me. And, you know, as things progressed, you know, things did get better, and I was able to compete at the, I guess it was the USA in 92 was the first real, I mean, besides that Junior Nationals, debacle. you know, that was the next time at that level.
And that was the one that Flex Wheeler won, where he turned pro.
So
that would be amazing to see, right?
Yeah, Flex won, and I think, was it Christian?
Chris Duffy, yeah.
Chris Duffy got second, and I was third. So, you know, but again, it was at that point in my career, I was just, you know, I had this kind of thing. It was the first time I really competed at that level, so I just had this thing in my mind, if I can just be known as one of the top five guys, how great would that be in, as far as amateurs go in the U.S.? And
yeah.
Then when you're that close, you're like, man, I want this. I can beat these guys. I think I can win. And
right.
So that was kind of my mindset going into the training. Again, then I just set my goals on the USA for the very next year. Then I got beat by Chris Cormier.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the Nationals that same year, and I was able to win that. So
yeah,
kind of the way it all went down.
Did you get hurt that year, Mike? Because I did an interview with Chris, and he said when he was getting ready for that USA in 93, he was looking at you. You know, he thought you would be his toughest competition, and some people were saying they heard that you got hurt. So he was like, I'm not going to believe that. I'm going to expect him to show up, and then you did show up, and you got second, and he won.
Man, no, I didn't get hurt at all, I don't think.
Okay, it must have just been a rumor going around. Yeah.
Dang, I wish they had convinced him. He could have let up a little bit.
Right.
You know, that one was a blur to me. I don't really remember much. I remember the first one, but I can't really. I remember Chris won. He looked great.
Yeah.
I just don't remember. Like, I just can't remember even accepting the second place trophy or any of that, really.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a kind of a foggy memory when it comes to that. But I do know Chris looked great, and he was a great bodybuilder, obviously. So there's absolutely no shame in losing to Flex Wheeler or Chris Cormier.
Yeah. Let's talk about that 93 Nationals, because that's the one where you won the overall. And Dennis Newman was second. Edgar Fletcher was third. So did you feel that out of those two USAs and that Nationals, that was your best condition, was that 93 Nationals?
You know, I was heavier. I was 228 at the USA, and I was 234 at the Nationals. And
wow.
I just remember thinking, man, am I going to be hard enough, you know? And I'm not sure. I went down there a week early, stayed with the guy, and I think it was a week, maybe a little bit more, but just to try to get used to it. But I was so humid down there. Things were a little different. And
where was that one at, Mike, the 93 Nationals?
That was in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
Yeah, so, but I just, and it was weird being out of my own element and not being, you know, just living
yeah.
the guy's apartment. Him, and then I think his girlfriend lived there, and you know, people coming in and out, and I just wasn't used to that.
Yeah,
I don't think
right.
I was that. I don't really shake up, and I think as far as hardness goes, that first or second USA, I was probably at my hardest, but I was
okay.
fuller and still in good shape and hard at the Nationals, I feel. But you know, that's I guess for other people to kind of judge. But that's the way I felt about it. And you know, it was a tough show, and I know, you know, Dennis obviously always comes in pretty good, his aesthetics are just phenomenal. And Edgar Fletcher just gets, and that guy never turned pro.
No, he never turned pro. He was one of those great
I put him in the same, yeah. I put him in the same category with, you know, you talk about Matt Mendenhall and other people that never,
yeah.
I put him right. I mean, I just can't imagine. If you look back at pictures, he'd be in there today like nothing. I mean, it'd be
yeah. Oh, yeah, crazy. For sure.
But yeah, so I knew those guys were going to be on the money, and they were, and I think Dennis even came back harder for the finals than he did the prejudging, which made him look even closer. So
yeah,
you know, so it was a tough show, and I think what Don Long was in it, Dean Caputo.
Yeah, he was fourth.
It,
Dean Caputo, right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of good guys. Again, it's just fun now, and looking in the rearview mirror, kind of looking back and seeing, you know, those guys in it, what they ended up doing, and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
But yeah,
part of the joy of it all, I think.
Did the judges tell you needed to be bigger from the USA to the Nationals after you got second first?
You know what? I never even talked to them. I just never was one really to say anything to the judges because
mm-hmm.
I trusted Chris, and he would not obviously lead me right down the right path, and whatever he said I would do. I can't remember really ever saying you need to be fuller. It's like it just kind of happened. You know, after a show, usually you'll put on, you know, at least – you know, after a show, I usually put on like 4 or 5 pounds of muscle pretty quickly just because you're going from almost catabolic, right, to
yeah.
really anabolic after a show because the you know, you're cutting out your cardio probably, you're eating much more,
yeah.
training heavier. And so I always look at it as a time with, especially the people I help, I say, look, don't take time off after a show. It doesn't mean you kill yourself, but just get in that gym because your body's going to be so anabolic. If you stay in there for 4 to 6 weeks, then you can take a week off if you want.
Right,
try to stay in there. And that's what I kind of philosophy I had, and I think that's probably part of the reason why I came in a little heavier, and maybe I could have been a couple pounds lighter and harder. I don't, know now. I don't remember how I had thought about it, but it all ended up working out.
Let me ask you about your training, Mike, because like I said, Chris Aceto's still talks. He's on that Heavy Muscle Radio with Dave Palumbo every week.
Right.
And he'll bring you up occasionally talking about how heavy you trained and how you didn't take much rest in between sets when you were training for a show. You'd still be using these super heavy weights, but you would just be like less than a minute. You'd be right back at it again. And so Tell us a little bit about that kind of training. Like, how many days a week did you train and what was your philosophy on training?
Yeah, well, my philosophy was to go as heavy as I can, as safely as I can, and keep the reps. I was probably, I did everything from singles and doubles, Louis' philosophy. Like, we'd do 8 sets of 2 sometimes, or somebody get on the squat rack, do 2 reps, he'd get out of there, I jump in 2 reps. So your weight can be really heavy, but the rest time is so short, it's almost like a body powerlifting type movement type
thing. Yeah.
And, so my philosophy revolved around heavy weights all the way to the show. Yeah, I might throw in one more, separation or detail exercise than I normally would in the off season. Mm-hmm. I try to keep the weights as heavy as I could on everything else. And my training 4 days a week, I still, when I help people, have them do that same thing.
Yeah.
I just think if you're hitting it, and people are different. I know their bodies respond to different things and all that, but, so you got to take that into consideration. But I generally think if you train as hard as I was training at that time, that I couldn't have done 2 body parts a week. It just wouldn't have been feasible, or I don't think it would have been beneficial. I kept, for instance, I would do Monday chest, biceps, Tuesday back, then have a day off, and then I would do either shoulders and triceps or do my legs, and then vice versa on Friday. So I go Monday, Tuesday, off Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, off weekends.
Right.
Again, getting ready for a show, you might be doing cardio, 5 or 6 of those days. But as far as the weight training goes, it was more of a 4-day-a-week, just heavy. And I'm telling you, it was only like 9 sets for biceps, 9 for triceps. Mm-hmm. Chest would probably be 9 to 12. Back would be a little bit more because you have you have so many different parts of your back, but it would probably be more like 18 sets.
Yeah.
Shoulders would be, maybe 12 to 15 sets. Legs, obviously, hamstrings probably 6 to 8, and quads probably another 12 to 18 sets. So it wasn't a tremendous amount of volume, but it was more heavy, moderate rep type stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was your leg workouts like, Mike? Because I've heard stories about how much you used to squat and stuff. And so, like, what exercise did you do? And like you said, the rep range would always vary, I'm sure. But
For instance, we do like a lot of that stuff I was just talking about, like 8 sets of 2. We do everything from this. Here's the range of things we do. Like 8 sets of 2 on squats where, you're pretty much just pushing the guy all the way to get up there and do it. And he's doing the same thing with you back and forth. I do everything from that to 20-20s. I still do them with people. But so you get on the leg press and you do 20 reps, then you get on the squat and do 20 reps back and forth. So he'd go, he'd finish his. When he was done with the squats, I'd jump in the leg press and then just keep going like that probably 4 or 5 times through. And the weight would be maybe 315 to 400 on squats and maybe maybe wide leg presses way up in the corners of the sled.
Yeah.
And probably... I don't know how many plates, you're throwing on there. I can't remember even, but it would be heavy, but you could get 20. By the time you're on your last set, you weren't able to get all the reps you'd need help.
Yeah.
So everything from that to, I remember squatting, the heaviest I remember going is in the 700-800 range and doing 75.
Wow, that's crazy. Wow. When you're doing those 20-20, how many sets would you do of those, Mike?
Like 4 or 5 sets of that, 4 or 5 times through.
Okay. Wow.
And then we'd probably do, we do leg extensions, maybe some hack squats. I did a lot of squatting, a lot of leg presses, the front squats too. But again, it would be change. We do the 8 sets of 2, 1 workout and then the auxiliary exercises. And the next leg day, we do the 20-20 thing. And then the next one, we might just go heavy for single reps. And the next one, we might go sets of 5.
Okay.
And I still believe that the variety is the important thing, to keep your muscle guessing, keep your body guessing, and I get used to it. And when it's on back, but for back for a whole year, at least a whole year when I really wanted to bring my back up, I was deadlifting, on the rack for 3 weeks, off the floor for 3 weeks, and then off a box, like a 5 or 6 inch box for 3 weeks.
Okay.
So we do, you know, and we what we do off the box, we go like 5 sets of 5, but off the rack and off the floor, we go to probably, we do like sets of five up until like 405, putting, you know, 90 more pounds on each time, 245s. Yeah. Then once we got to 405, after that, we just start doing singles until we couldn't get any more, or until it was so hard that you knew you wouldn't get another
set. Right.
So that I did for over a year, just straight, just wow. trying to get my back bigger. And it worked. I mean, it was a, went from being one of my probably weaker points to one of my better points, I think.
Yeah, you had an incredible back, especially your lower back and spinal erector. So I could tell you were doing those deadlifts.
Yeah, that helped. And Louie had this machine, you've probably seen, it's called a reverse hyper.
Yeah.
Throw that in a lot too. It also hit your glutes and your hamstrings, but it would get your lower back a lot, which, you know, a lot of bodybuilders, they had the upper back, but they didn't have some of that lower back development. So,
right.
So it's a way to set yourself apart a little bit.
How heavy did you go on the deadlifts?
Man, I know out of the rack probably had to be probably 800 to 900 pounds, and off the floor probably around, man, I'm guessing again, but had to be around 700 to 800, something like that.
Damn, that's crazy.
Looking back, it is crazy, because when I see guys do it now, which you don't see guys doing that a lot. I don't know.
No, you don't.
That's a whole nother episode. We could talk about the training now compared to then, but
yeah.
But you just don't. I don't know. I hate to even be that guy, but yeah, it's like we walked uphill the school both ways in the snow. But I just don't see it anymore. I don't see guys going in there. They want all the results, but it doesn't seem like they want to just do the nitty gritty, crazy heavy weights and
yeah.
You know, without all those bands and just all
right,
that other stuff.
Right.
Well, even just did much of that. Or Ronnie did much of that, you know. So I don't think you really needed that.
And even what you said earlier about training just 4 days a week, and when you train that heavy, you need that recovery. I hear so many people nowadays talking about, I need to bring my back up, so I'm going to hit it 4 days a week. And I'm like, how can you hit back 4 days a week if you're training hard? You know, because if you do a heavy leg workout, for example, your legs should be sore for 5 of those days at least, you know. So how are you going to do 4 workouts a week?
Oh, I agree totally. And so your legs are sore, and then how do you do deadlifts with your legs being sore?
Right,
you
know?
And one thing leads to another. You're going to continuously be sore. You're going to get hurt, overtraining, or you're just not going that hard. And that's probably what it is.
I just
changed the kid's workout the other day. He's doing, just a kid starting out, but he's got a leaner type physique where he needs to just do crazy. He needs to do heavy weights, and he needs to lower his reps, just get that thickness on. But he was training everything twice a week, and his weight was actually going down. He's trying not eating enough food. It's just amazing, you know. And we all started somewhere, putting this kid down at all. But you know, you look at it from your viewpoint or mine, where we've been there, and it's like, what are you doing? I don't know where they get this stuff, but the internet's, I think, a conduit for a lot of that bad information.
Oh, I do. I do too. I think it's all the YouTube stuff they're watching. Yeah.
So it's just, I guess that's a whole other thing. We saw like old men griping, but but I believe it. I mean, I just thoroughly believe that they're just not training as hard these days, but they want the same results.
Right.
And that's why I think people are comparing a lot the 90s to now and things. Just, just because I think it's a lot to do with the training and mentality.
Yeah. I remember also one thing you said before in the magazines was when you started training with the powerlifters, and maybe this was when you were training at Louis' gym, you said you had to learn how to take more rests in between sets in order to get stronger.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, if you want to lift heavier, you know, powerlifters, they'll sit there for 5 minutes in between lifts. And
right.
That was a bit much for me, but I had to kind of tone it down a little bit. But I did find a guy over there. I don't know if you ever heard Chuck Vogelpool, but he's one of the best powerlifters in the world in his day. And so he was out there, and we'd just go back and forth. He would go, I would go. He'd go, I would go. So, you know, but we couldn't do that all the time. And when we were going heavier on some lifts, we had to, back off on the time, which was hard for me to learn, but you have to do it once in a while to get a little bit more rest time in. I don't think you need 5 minutes as a bodybuilder, but, you know, maybe two minutes just to let your body pretty much recover. And you don't need to be fully recovered, because if you're a bodybuilder, you're not you know, if you can lift heavy, great, but it's not about the weights. It's about, you know, your form, and it's about working on your weaknesses and the exercise and things like that, not necessarily just about heavy weights. So that's another thing I had to learn when I was at Westside, is I had to learn when I had to back off a little bit and get out of there for a week or two, because they'll keep pushing you. If you're ready to go, they'll keep pushing you. But when you're making your living doing something and you know that if you rip a muscle, you could be done like in a second. You have to know when to back off, which makes you feel, you know, terrible that you have to do that in Louis Zone. What are you doing? But there's certain times I just had to get out of there for a week or two and then come back and apologize to Louis and get back and get his good grace and go back. But this is something you learn. But man, talk about learning to push you and get the most out of you and things like that. They were great at it there.
Yeah. What else did you do for your back, Mike? Did you do a lot of bent over rows, like barbell rows, T bars?
Yeah, reverse grip. Yep, reverse grip, bent overs, shrugs. We did that reverse hyper deadlifts. You know, just the basics. I mean, people think it's some crazy stuff, but it's just the basics. And I tell you exactly how my workout went. It would go warm up for the deadlifts, and then do those deadlifts out of the rack, off the floor, off the box, like I said. And then we would go directly over to cable rows, and we'd do like four sets of 10 heavy, heavy. And then I would jump on the reverse hyper and do those probably, you know, four or five sets of 15 or 20 reps. And then we would do shrugs, where I'd sit on a bench and have the bar be underneath the bench, kind of like a covered bar.
Yeah, those are good.
Do shrugs seated. And then we'd finish with pull downs to the chest, for like you know, sets of 10 or whatever, four times through. So that was my workout for a year more straight. And then the bent over rows and stuff I started doing after kind of that year. I started doing more bent over reverse grip rows and things like that. So it's a great middle back thickness exercise. And I mean, Dorian did a lot of them. Look at his back. So that was something I did a lot of, but that was it. You know, we didn't have at the gym at the time, you know, it's probably the best gym in Columbus as far as the, for me, was World Gym at that time. And, and they didn't have a lot of that hammer machine things and all that. They had old machines, but they didn't have any much hammer equipment, so to speak, like that. You know, a lot of those rowing machines, the reverse grip row, all that kind of thing, they didn't have that. So, so I enjoyed doing it when I traveled and we'd go to other gyms. They had some of it, but we didn't have it at our gym. So just the basics. And you know, that's why you see all these guys doing all this stuff. And I'm like, that's great, I guess, if you need that to keep your attention or whatever. And I'm not saying it's going to make your back bad or whatever body part, but, you know, the basics are still where it's at. I mean,
yeah, the basics are what's going to build the muscle, right?
When they talk to Ronnie, what do they want to talk about? His squatting, his deadlifting. When they talk to Dorian, he has bent over rows and everything he does. So
yeah,
no one talks about, you know, how many chains did you have on there? How many bands did you have on there?
Right.
You know, or whatever. What this new machine might. I mean, no one talks about that. And and those are the best physiques of all time.
Right. So, exactly.
Pretty good role model.
Was Dorian a big influence at that time, Mike? Because he was winning the Olympia then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would never say it at the time, but looking back, I mean, I'm huge story. I think, to me, you know, and this isn't putting anybody down at all, any of the other guys at all, any better than I am, but they, but Dorian just to me is the epitome of Mr. Olympia. I know, just like, it's built from scratch, and he just went in there and trained hard. He just went back to Europe and England and just hibernated and did his thing and came out and look what he, you know, look at what happened.
Yeah.
And this physique just looks like it's chiseled out of stone, you know? I don't know. I just, that's to me what Mr. Olympia is all about. It's not about necessarily who has the best genetics and the roundest muscle. To me, you know, what Dorian did and just kind of the way he took care of his business, he's quiet, did his thing. To me, that's just all in one package, you know, the epitome of what Mr. Olympia is all about. So, So, yeah, I mean, obviously, I think your competition, you know, should motivate you. If it doesn't, it's probably a problem, you know, because if you look at somebody and you're not fired up to beat them or get it, you know, be better than them or as good as them, or if that doesn't inspire you to train harder, then, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, yeah. So after you win the Nationals in 93, then you go into the 94, you start doing the pro shows, and your first one, actually your first two, you won, which was the Chicago Pro, and then you went into the Night of the Champions, which was a very prestigious show at that time, and you won both of those shows.
Yeah, again, you know, you just don't know how you're going to stand next to those guys.
Yeah.
Get up there, and how you're going to look, and but again, I trusted Chris, and he seemed very confident, and so that confidence carried over to me, and was able to win, you know, was able to win both those shows, you know, with good guys in there, and you know, Nasser was in the Night of Champions, and you know, a lot of other, Mike Quinn was still there. That was kind of cool because Gaspari was in one of them too. So at that one, maybe at Chicago, excuse me, but it was fun looking back and seeing, you know, being able to compete against guys like that are legends in the sport.
Yeah,
and so. But at the time, I didn't really think about it that much because you're just going out there. There's a guy next to you. I don't care. I'm not really paying attention to him because I'm just there to do my thing. But looking back, it's pretty neat to say I competed against those guys. Like Lee Labrada was in the night or the Arnold one.
Yeah.
95 one. And so, I mean, to be able to compete against him, obviously.
Yeah.
The greatest of all time. So, yeah, that was fun. And those, you know, obviously the guys later, like Flex, and those are also the greats of all time, Dorian. But at that time, the legends were Mike Quinn, Lee Labrada, Lee Haney, and those kind of guys.
Yeah, for sure. How was Chris helping you with the diet? Was he helping you in the off season as well as before a contest? Because I would think, you know, with your size, you would need quite a few, you know, a lot of calories and probably a lot of carbs and stuff in order to train, especially as heavy as you were training and everything.
Yeah, he helped me, and he generally, I'd tell him what I was going to do, and he'd give me the okay when it came to off season. You know, I didn't really have a problem with ever putting on, you know, a ton of body fat. So that wasn't really an issue. And so he gave me guidance, but it wasn't that anything that I had to follow, like strict day-to-day thing with the off season. But pre-contest, I mean, I wasn't eating one carb if he wasn't telling me to. I mean,
right.
The reason I always thought, if Chris said eat 9 ounces of red meat, he said 9 ounces, not 10 ounces, not 8.5. It was nine.
Right.
There was a reason for that. And I'm going to do it.
Right.
You know, and then obviously when you do have some success, you start to, even though I believe them wholeheartedly, you start to believe in them more. But it's just like a brother to me. I mean, we said, you know, you know how it is. You sit in the hotel room after prejudging, before the show. We'd go in town a lot of times, 3 or 4 days before a show. So, and then a lot of times he would fly in. I'd fly him into Columbus to be with me like the week before we took off for the show. So
wow.
I didn't see me all the time, and I just wanted him eyes on, hands on. So if we need to make any adjustments, he could do it like that without me. Because in those days, I'll tell you how long ago this was, but in those days, I was taking pictures. My wife would take pictures of whoever, my training partner in the gym. I'd run over to the one-hour photo, have him developed, come back an hour later, get him, go to FedEx, and have him next day to Chris. And then he would get the pictures, and I just couldn't wait for that phone call.
Yeah.
And Chris would say, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's what we're going to do. You know, as opposed to now where they could, you know, just take a picture with your phone in the gym and send it to him instantaneously or do a video and he could see you. So that's how it was back then. But it worked for us and we were able to do it. And then pre-contest, obviously, like I said, I was following exactly what Chris told me to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing I always liked about Chris was he was always had a lot of common sense in his approach to dieting. You know, he never did anything extreme. At least that's, to me, it seems that's the way he always approached things. And all this stuff just made a lot of sense, you know, the way he advised people on dieting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's what I try to do with people myself is just because that's what I learned. Chris, this is no nonsense. And it's not all this, you know, manipulation, small, minute things. It was just a common sense, like you said, approach to whatever it was, but nutrition. That's what he is with everything in his life, quite honestly.
Yeah,
that's
true.
What he was. He's just so matter of fact, and just, you know, sees right through the BS and sees right to what you need to do. And so that's what I learned from Chris and what I try to find. And people make it too difficult. It's just not that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You need the guidance probably, but it's not that difficult to guide somebody if they'll just follow through with what you say. And that's the hard part. Because the easy part is telling somebody what to do. I mean, the hard part is getting it done.
And
I tell people, look, I have the easy job. You're the one that has to do the work. So if you don't do it, you know, it's not going to happen. You know, my wife gets frustrated. I do diets for people and things like that, and I'll say, it just doesn't need to be that complicated. It just needs to, she's like, but they won't want to eat the same thing every day. I'm like, don't they want the results? You know, and, you know, some people don't. Some people just can't eat the same thing every day, and they're not after it because they want to be Mr. Olympia. They just want to be in shape. Vacation.
Yeah.
And, you know, you work with those kind of people too. And sometimes I lose sight of that. She brings me back to reality. Like, these people need more balanced thing here because their goal isn't to get ready for a show, it's to get ready for the beach.
Yeah, they're not as hardcore as we were.
Yeah, exactly.
So after your success in 94, Mike, were people telling you to do the Olympia that year?
Yeah, you know, yes. And I just felt like I wasn't ready. I wanted to. I won my first two, and I just felt like, you know, if I want to win the Olympia, which I never did, never looked, I felt good at that show at all, but I just felt like I should take the time off and then get ready for that the next year. And in fact, I think I skipped the Arnold. I did skip the Arnold the following year. So I just went from like Olympia to kind of like I did with the USA. I guess not. I went from the night champion, skipped the Olympian Arnold and did the Olympia. So set my sights set on that. Looking back, I'm not sure it was the best thing to do, but, that's what I did. And I can't remember, you know, if I talked to Chris about it, he thought it was the best thing. I just can't remember how it all went down. It's been so long. But looking back, I probably should have maybe done. I never have regrets. I just do what I do, and then that I'm done with it. But looking back, I probably should have done it just to see where I stood, because you're kind of hot at the time, and maybe it's good to keep going. But at the same time, you know, if you need to make improvements, that wasn't really enough time to make any improvements.
Yeah, that's true. Because you're going for the spring shows for the fall, so it wasn't my time.
Yeah, I mean, that's why a lot of times, you know, if you do the Arnold's or the Olympia, it's hard to do, or the Arnold, excuse me, it's hard to do the Olympia and make great improvements. You get better shape, maybe put on a pound or two, but it's difficult to get geared up to do it and have any off season and make it feel like you made any progress at all. So you can see why some guys sit that out. As much as I know the promoters want people in there and the fans want people in there, it's not as easy as everybody would think. You know, they just think you just poof, you diet, and you get the same shape every time. You know, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
So, there's very few people come in great shape. I mean, they come in shape, but not phenomenal shape every time.
Yeah, it's hard to peak for both when you're doing both in the same year. Yeah,
hard to trick your body into it, hard to do mentally, and just a lot of things. But so, yeah, I did skip it, and then skipped the Arnold, and then went to the Olympia next year, that year. So.
Yeah, let's talk about the Arnold that you won in 95, Mike, because that was kind of an upset because you beat Flex, although he was coming back from that car crash. But I was actually at that show. I get to see it, and I remember when me and my friends were in the audience watching, and you came out for the prejudging. My friend turned to me, and you know, we thought Flex was probably going to win because he was the big name. And my friend turned to me, and he goes, "Man, Mike's going to win it," you know. So because you looked so amazing that year, and so then you did pull the upset, and you beat Flex Wheeler as well as, like you said, Lee Labrada, and Munzer was in it, and Charles Claremont. So you had a superstar lineup there. So how did that one feel? That had to be one of the highlights of your career, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the highlight as far as the pro shows go. And it was on my birthday as well, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah, March 4th, yeah.
March 4th. But, yeah, and to beat somebody like Flex, you know, and then be able to compete against those other guys and do it in my, you know, I guess adopted hometown in a sense, even though I live
still my,
but do it in front of the people that, you know, have seen me progress from winning, you know, the World Gym Classic to, you know, all along until the Arnold Classic and be in that gym and have those people in the audience. And I'm sure, I mean, I would, you know, get pleasure out of seeing somebody like that did that. So I'm hoping that that's what they felt too, because it was a team win. Mm-hmm. Not just me, it's all the people that, I'm sure a lot of those people in the audience at one time or another spotted me in the gym when I needed help. I didn't have a partner there and encouraged me in some way. You know, it's a good luck and all that all along. So there's a big part of it. So winning it here in Columbus, of all the highlights, you know, and having my family here, my mom and dad and wife, and was huge. And I think my brothers too. So, it was great winning here. And you know, and that's something later on in life, you kind of almost forget, but know, people remember that and approach you about it and things like that. And yeah, I was there when you won that. I remember that. That's just it. Hopefully they get a good feeling from it, because I do. You know,
yeah.
It's a good thing.
And it was on TV back then, so that was a big deal, right?
Yeah, it was Don Crickey, the announcer. And Arnold, and it was on TV. And, it used to be, I don't know. I mean, like we said earlier, bodybuilding used to be more covered in coverage than it is now.
Yeah.
It was fun.
And that was a network, too, right? Like, was it an NBC, I think, that was on?
Yeah, I think it was NBC,
yeah. Yeah. Was that the first time you met Arnold?
No. Oh, man. I'm trying to think. I was around him before that, here and there, but I don't think I'd ever really formally met him. Maybe I did at one grand opening of a gym somewhere along the line, because Jim Lormer, who runs the show with Arnold, is local here, so maybe. But anyway, it's the first time I can really remember, anyway. And it's ironic, I met, you know, at the time, his wife Maria, too, and because all my wife wants to talk to you, she heard you're a good Catholic boy, studying for the priesthood. And I was thinking, okay, your wife wants to meet me. I wasn't even thinking about who his wife really was. I knew, obviously, but I just wasn't. And then I went over and said, oh, yeah, it's Maria Shriver. I forgot. So I was able to talk to her a little bit. And, that was neat. And my mom and dad were here. And, you know, obviously my wife back there. So just sharing it with them was neat. And meeting Arnold for the first time and just kind of being around him a little bit. And but all that was pretty cool. And, you know, at the time, again, you're just kind of going along, taking things for granted a little bit. But, you know, every once in a while, you know, I see the video or I give a talk and I show the video a little bit to kind of familiarize people with who I am and what that kind of thing. And you forget a lot about, you know, the things you're able to do through bodybuilding, meet Arnold and meet other people like that. And that's pretty cool. And feel blessed to have that happen. And also to have my family participate in that, too, is another highlight for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, he was very complimentary of your physique. I remember at that show.
Yeah, I know he did that Telestrator thing and all that, but you just don't know what somebody's, you know, thinking, because I guess these days we've heard him a few times get all over people's physique. So, so I'm glad he held off on mine. At least
I think he was impressed with your muscle mass, and he could see, you know, the powerful look you had. I think that's what was impressive to him.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell the heavyweights that went into the work as opposed to, you know, more of just a genetic look. But anyway, yeah, it was great.
How did it feel beating Flex? Because he was such a big name back then, and that was kind of an upset.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was definitely an upset. Flex always been, you know, we've never been best friends or anything, but he's always been very kind to me. And way back with some times we were at, I don't know if he remembers, but with Gold's Gym after one of the USAs, you know, he was, you know, came up and just started talking to me and said, hey, there's some things you can do to help your physique, and kind of, you know, excuse me, talk to me about a few things and things like that. So, we've, although not been best friends by any means, but been very cordial to each other, and he's very, very good to me all along. It wasn't one of those things where I beat Flex and I can't stand him. It was one of those things where, I beat Flex. He was a great bodybuilder and he's a good guy. And so that's kind of the way I walked away feeling about it. And, you know, looking back, I think he won a bunch of Arnolds in a row or one more. And so that would have been another one. But and so I was able to at least stop that for a little bit, even though I know he won one or two for sure after that, I think. So he's phenomenal. I mean, he, to me, just God-given. And he put a lot of work into it, too. I've seen his pictures. When he was starting out, and you would never guess he was going to be what he was.
I know, yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. So he put a lot of hard work into it. But just also, God blessed him with genetics that are just, to me, I think, still to this day, even though I think, you know, Dorian's physique, Mr. Olympia, we're talking about that, is one thing. But Flex, just God-given gift of the shape and roundness and everything, this aesthetics, just phenomenal with him. And there's no way to this day I think that's has been able to do that same thing or be that same type of structure quite. There's guys that are close, but something about Flex is different that I think the other guys haven't quite gotten that yet.
Yeah, and it was so long ago, I think we kind of forget how great he was. I just posted a picture on my Facebook page from 93 when he took second at the Olympia, and I was just shocked at how incredible he looked. You know, he would have won the Olympia easily this year if someone like that went in, you know?
Oh, yeah, I know. There have been a lot of guys. I mean, LeBroni would have done it. I think there's other guys that would have. It was just a tough era.
Yeah, it was.
There's good guys now, but there might be one or two that are kind of on that same level, and the rest I don't think are quite there, in my opinion, from what I see. But and I don't know, there's something, too, about the personalities. There's more personalities and stories than kind of different things. Guys from all over the place, just kind of, I don't know, just something magical kind of about that. Late 80s, 90s thing that, they say golden era or whatever, but it's kind of, it's kind of like that when you look at the whole picture. I just think it's one of those eras that will kind of stand on its own, similar to when Tom Platz and those guys were there in those days.
You think the magazines helped that too, Mike? Because back then, all we had was the magazines. There was no internet. So the only way we could find out about contest results or who the guys were was we had to read the magazines. And I think that allowed us to get to know each individual a little bit more,
Yeah, I feel that. And I remember, I didn't look at them a lot, but when I did look at them, every month they'd come out, so you had to wait for that next month or whatever.
Yeah.
And now it's just inundated over the internet with all this information. So some of it, I think it's information overload. Some of it you don't even really pay attention to because there's just so much of it and doctored photos. And because I've never seen anybody look on stage like they seem to look in their Facebook page or Instagram. I don't know what they're doing, but there's something that, they just look like, oh my gosh, no one's ever been that hard ever in mankind. And then they get to the show and they get on stage and you're like, it doesn't look like that. I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
And, so that kind of bugs me in a way. But you're right. I mean, the magazines, there's just something, like I said before, I think I overused the word, but magical about those magazines and the guys that get on the cover and the things you see and the great articles by Peter McGuff, who I think is the best of all time writing. And Chris Lund's pictures, Irvin Gallup's pictures. I mean, just some phenomenal stuff. And there's a lot more photographers, too, that were great. But I just, something great about that time and those. And I think the magazines disappearing have taken away from that whole thing of that same feeling, just because, we're this information saturated society now. And I don't know, there's something different about the whole thing. And also, I think, with the kind of institution or the of these other the physique and the classic physique and things too has kind of maybe taken away a little bit from the bodybuilding.
I talked to Peter McGuff, and I think even Chris Aceto mentioned this. It's like the difference now is, I remember back then with the magazines, you had to wait like 3 months to read about the contest. If the Mr. Olympia happened, you had to wait like 3 months in the magazine to read it. So we were also anxious to find out what happened. And then Peter would write these long articles and all the detail of stuff that happened backstage and stuff that was going on stage, how all the physiques looked, and he would analyze them all. And you'd really take it all in, and that's what you kind of read about and talked about for the next year until the next Olympia. And I think Chris Aceto mentioned this too. He said, now it's like, all we do is we get the results instantaneously because it's on, like a live feed or something, or somebody's posting pictures immediately after it happens. And then that's it.
Right.
The next day, it's like, it's over. That's it. We forget about it. There's no detail. There's no, you don't find out what happened at the show because there's no written articles. There's no, long explanations of all the things that really happened, all the details. And it's just over so quick. And then it's just, okay, let's move on to the next thing. It just seems like
Christmas.
So.
It's like Christmas. Yeah. All the anticipation, one day, and then you're like, next day, you're taking out
the
garbage,
it's over.
But in other words, you should stop and enjoy the day and enjoy the time, enjoy Christmas Day and the birth of Christ, and enjoy the show and the guys that win and read the information about them and just take that all in. And that's what, you go back to that magazine 20 times. What do you say about this guy? What did Peter say about that guy?
Maybe
these pictures that Chris Lund took and you would do that and it just, made it more important. And now,
Yeah.
Chris said, like you said, I mean, it's just, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? Who's going to be the next guy? What's this
right.
guy doing? You know,
so right. Right.
Instead of look, just, you know, enjoying a little bit and taking it all in. So I wholeheartedly believe that same thing.
It was like the Olympia this year when Sean Roden beat Phil Heath. It was like the day after or the next week, people were like, well, is he going to do it again next year?
Like, yeah.
We're not even going to talk about the one that just happened, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Let the guy enjoy it and let people take it in a little bit. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's automatically, is he going to be able to do it next time? You know?
Right, right, right. So in 95, Mike, after you did the Arnold Classic win, you also won the San Jose Pro Invitational the week, it was like a week after, right?
Right, yes.
And then you did your Olympia, your first Olympia that year, correct?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So, yeah, I hate even talking about it, but yeah, I got seventh place. It's the best I ever did at the Olympia.
Right.
I never really talk about results and what it is, but I thought I could have been placed a little bit better, but mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't good enough to win, so what's the difference?
Yeah.
So I got seventh, and yeah, I don't know, poor score or whatever, but I left the Rams in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my wife's in the crowd, and I think, I don't know, my mom and dad were there too, and then her mom and dad, and I just, when I came off stage, and no one saw it, I took my medal and just threw it in the trash can. I just,
oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, no one saw it. No one saw it. It was nothing like I was making a scene at all or anything like that. I just was so disappointed in myself placing that. But I got to be better than this. And I said 1-4 before that, and, you know, you win the Nationals, and I said, higher expectations for myself, and I got mm-hmm. you know, so I feel like I let myself down. No one else letting me down. I was letting myself down, and then I just went out to put my stuff, went out the back door, and somehow found the hotel, which wasn't connected to the venue at all. I walked probably, I don't know, a couple miles. Mm-hmm. Probably not the smartest thing to do. anywhere, let alone Atlanta. I made my way back to the hotel, and they were looking for me and my wife, and I just was disgusted, and you know, I never ended up doing better, though, so maybe I should have enjoyed it more.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what I got, and so then went back. Okay, what was that year?
That was 95, and then 96, you did the Olympia again. I think you got 10th in 96.
Yeah, yeah. And then that's when I started getting my, you know, colitis, and some things started going downhill for me, so right after that. And
okay.
I think I did the Arnold one more time, and then the
Olympics. Yeah, 97, you got third.
Yeah. So then I was getting ready for Arnold again when get ahead of myself here, but then that's when I got crazy sick, and then I couldn't even, yeah, had to have my colon removed and stuff. And so that's when it all ended.
So you started feeling that colitis a couple years, huh, before you actually knew it?
Yeah. And looking back, there's symptoms there, but at the time, you know, there's symptoms for a lot of things. So I never thought, I didn't know what colitis really was. So
yeah.
You know, you have little things that aren't what they should be. Like my stomach, if you look back at most pictures, my upper abs are a little bit, it's not as deep as my lower abs. And that is part of that because your intestine is. So I look back at the pictures and I see some of the symptoms, but at the time I had no idea. And it doesn't mean you're necessarily experiencing, you know, outwardly symptoms or things that you're feeling bad necessarily. It can just be things that are going on and kind of visually you see it, but so it's started affecting my physique you know, earlier than I thought, but it just really got crazy at the last, you know, the last year, six to eight months probably. I was going with the Olympia and had to go to every year that was 97 Olympia, had to go to the hospital a couple days and get, I think, fluids and just some other things. But the doctor went ahead and let me do the Olympia. And then I just, you know, I didn't tell Weider. I didn't tell anybody because I had a contract with him. I didn't want to lose my contract or have anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And so I just kept it quiet and went to the Olympia. I think I got 10th or 11th. I think somebody tested positive. So I moved up a spot. But regardless. And then I had to go on the medicines and everything for the colitis. And it actually started going away. The doctor, when they scoped me, said, hey, if we didn't know you had it, it would be hard to tell that, you know, you even still have it. So go ahead and continue your training, get ready for the Arnold Classic. And then when they took me off the medicine, slowly it just got worse and worse. And then the second time around, the medicines just weren't doing anything. So
wow.
That's when I was like a week out from the Arnold and had to be hospitalized. And they took my colon out, and then had to wait another 12 weeks, I think it was, after that to have my colon, well, colon's gone, but have my small intestine reattached. And that's when things just got really bad, and I had a lot of complications, and actually like a 10% chance of living at one point.
Jeez, really? Wow.
Yeah, things were just going bad. And then, you know, they had my family there, they gathered in the room and all that kind of stuff. I had my, you know, the familiar of the sick, they used to call it last rites a couple times.
Yeah, wow, no kidding, I didn't know that. So
I remember very little of it. I was, you know, intubated for a lot of it, and just out of it for, I don't even remember, like 2 or 3 weeks of it. So
so was that when they did the surgery to attach the small intestine to the colon?
They did it the first time. They took my colon out. But when they reattach, what they do when they take your colon out, you have a colon, it's called an ileostomy, which is the bag coming out of your stomach, right?
So yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honest.
And without being too graphic, but so then the second surgery, they take that down and they attach your small intestine. The reason they do that is just to let that healing from the surgery happen. And then the second surgery was called a takedown surgery. So they take that off and they reattach your small intestine. It's supposed to, they make a thing called a J pouch within inside your body. And it's supposed to kind of take the place of a colon, but I mean, it's 1/10 probably the size. So, it doesn't really do a lot, but, and that second time through is I started having internal bleeding and start throwing up blood in the hospital one morning and that's when my, you know, they got everybody and, you know, they thought that was going to pretty much be it because my blood pressure had dropped so significantly in my heart. I remember being wheeled down because I started throwing up the blood. My wife had just left in the morning. She stayed overnight with me every night in the hospital. My mom and dad came and they would come in the morning and stay with me during the day. And then my wife would come again over after work. And then, she's a financial planner, and then she would come after work and she would stay with me overnight and then go back to the house in the morning, change, go to work. So she did that for a month straight while I was in the hospital.
Wow.
My mom and dad would come and stay with me, and then one morning Shannon had left already, and then I started to feel like I had to throw up, and I threw up. It was all blood. And then so my dad, he was just the most calm guy in the entire world. He's like, well, you know, maybe we should get the nurse in here. Like, yeah, probably a good idea. But he's just one of those guys that's beyond calm and doesn't, if he is excited, he doesn't show it. So,
right.
But anyway, so that happened. Then the doctor came and then he was on the phone trying to get other surgeons there. And then they wheeled me down and they had called Shannon at home, no cell phones at that time.
Yeah.
And rushed my dad, called her, said, you better get in here. And so then she came and then her, my buddy was a doctor. Dr. Eric Swan, I don't know if you know Eric, but he, you know, so they tried to find me and then they found me and I was being wheeled down the thing, doctors and stuff all around, she said, and you know, the story and then they took me into the lab and I remember in the lab and they're trying to get blood in me to you know, give me blood because I was bleeding internally and I remember the doctor saying, you know, we're losing them, I don't want to lose them, you know, and then I said to them, he goes, we got to intubate them. And then I remember saying, are you going to put me out when you intubate me? And he goes, yes. And then I was out. So,
wow.
And then probably 2 or 3 weeks went by where I don't remember much of anything. And then gradually, thank God, I started getting better. And I was able to make it through it. But you know, I was roughly 270 about a week out, 2 weeks out, I think it was, from the Arnold. And then I came out of the hospital the second time. Between June and July, weighing 170 pounds.
Oh my God, that's 100 pounds. Wow.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it's 100 pounds. Today I weigh about, 200 pounds. So.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, so I don't mean to be that involved with the story, but that's kind of that's the gist of it. And, you know, I know a lot of people have asked me about it and heard about it, but that's,
right.
That's the bottom line on how it all went down. So.
And then what happened after that, Mike? How did they make it better?
Well, they took my colon out, so that's where the infection was, and that's where, yeah, so once they take that out, as far as that problem goes, I ended up having other complications, but with the other things that had happened, but those, once they were cured or whatever, you know, that all kind of went away. So after that, it's the only thing is, you know, I have no colon, so you know, that's a lot of the storage for your food once it's being digested, after it's digested. Mm-hmm. And so it just means more trips to the bathroom, and it just means some changes in your lifestyle, things like that that you just have to get used to and learn to deal with. That's the only thing, just can't eat a ton of food, and it goes through you a lot quicker than it did before. So that's really the only ramifications. Just maybe lifestyle changes and just learning. I can eat anything I want, but I eat healthy anyway. But you just learn which foods that you can eat, and which foods that you should probably stay away from, and that type of thing.
Okay.
But through the whole thing too, I will say this. Weeder, stood behind me. He didn't have to. Joe at the
time. Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I had a contract with Champion when I first started, and then in 95 I got a Weeder contract, and he's really good to me, and he could have easily just said, that's it, this guy's sick, we're done, because they can stop that anytime, contracts are written. But he stood behind me, gave me a contract for another year while I got on my feet and started my training business. And
wow, that's great.
Show and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, all the things they say about Joe that, are negative, there's some things in there. That's just the way Joe is, or Joe was, telling you that the good things they say about Joe Weeder are very good things. And I can't. I have nothing negative to say about Joe. He's very good to me and my family and helping us out in that time, because, he didn't have to do that. It made things a lot easier with my recovery, not having that stress of worrying about, the next year of
the money.
Like that. Right. I didn't have to do anything just to get better. So,
that's great.
The blessing, So, yeah. So throw that in, because you hear a lot of things, and they're doing that movie about Joe now, and I haven't been to it, but
comes out next week.
There might be some negative sides in there. I don't know, but all I can say is my experience with him is very positive.
Yeah. So that was 20 years ago, pretty much, right, Mike? And you're doing good now. You said you're 200 pounds, right?
Yeah, 200 pounds, and I feel good. No complaints at all. I'm just enjoying the family. My two boys are freshmen in high school now, which is hard to believe.
Wow.
Around when I was competing. And, just trying to enjoy them. And, as we grow older, we just realize you got to slow down a little bit and take stock of everything.
Yeah.
And
what's important.
What's important in life, exactly. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
And how long you and Shannon been married now?
We've been married we got married in 1991. So what is that, 27 years?
That's great.
Yeah. Yep, stood behind me the whole way. For some reason.
The trooper.
I mean, putting up all the stuff with bodybuilding, and then me being sick, and then me starting kind of a second career with this other stuff. But she's been obviously a big part of it, and I couldn't do it. If someone happened to her, I'd be sunk. So, thank God, and he put her in my life, and.
I never met her, but I remember seeing her on the broadcast of the Arnold Classic, and you could tell she was totally behind you.
Yeah, she is, and led me down the right path a lot when I could have made some stupid decisions here and there. I don't want to say it too loud; she might hear me. she's been a blessing for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mike, I want to thank you for the time for joining us on the podcast, and it's been great talking to you. I had a chance to see you compete when you were in your prime and competing in the 90s, and you always seemed like a really great guy, so I'm glad you had the chance to sit down and talk with us for a while.
I am, too. I appreciate you having me on. It's been great. I followed your career, too. You're an awesome bodybuilder. So,
thank you, Mike.
You should interview yourself for your show.
Yeah, maybe I'll try and do that one of these days.
Yeah. Hey, we have Blair Moen and I have a show, too.
We
started recently. It's Old School. I don't know if you know Blair, but Old School.
Yeah, Muscle, I do.
TV and School with a K. But we'd like to have you maybe on sometime, too, and talk about your career.
Yeah, I'd love that. Now. Yeah.
So it's fun to do. And we kind of like you, we talk about, things that how they've changed and maybe what's good now, what's bad now, and things like that.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the old stuff and also try to be relevant too in today's world. So
what's the name of the podcast again, Mike?
It's Old School Muscle TV. School is SKOOL.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Got going with it. It's fun. It's fun to do. And we eventually want to go on YouTube with it, but right now we're just the podcast thing. And so we'll see how it goes. It's fun to do and hopefully get some good information out similar to what you're doing.
Yeah. Okay. I'll definitely check it out.
All right. I appreciate it.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for joining us, and take care of yourself, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks. I really do appreciate it. Thanks, John. Bye.
Okay, take care. All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to really thank Mike Francois for taking the time to do an interview. I always admired Mike, as I said, growing up, so it was great to get to talk to him. He was really a humble, confident champion, and it was really awesome to get to spend some time with him. I do want to say thanks to our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And join us next week when we'll be talking to 1970s bodybuilding star Richard Baldwin about his time competing in the 1970s and 80s. All right, we'll see you guys next week. Take care.